No, I wasn't home today. I didn't take it with me this morning.
Can we email it to you after?
But I don't know. I'll just do with this. Whatever you want. Okay, we're ready? So I'm sorry I wasn't here last week. So consequently, maybe we'll do some things a little more general than we would have done it otherwise. So let's think a little bit about Sefer Shemot generally, and then we'll get to this week's Parsha as well. On a general level, we need to do a couple of things. And that is, yes, it's a new book. How do I know it's a new book? Because at the end of Vayechi, we said Chazak, Chazak. So I know it's a new book. You look at the Sefer Torah, there's a space, it's a new line, new book. Okay, I know completely it's a new book. So that's clear. We all get that. The thing is that when I say it's a new book, how far is it separated from the old book? So I'm going to start by suggesting that we need to do two things, which are completely opposite things. One is to read Shemot as a continuation of Bereshit. Yeah, Bereshit ended, they're all dead, right? But read it as a continuation. So again, just an example for that. When we get to a pasuk at the beginning that says that a new pharaoh arose who didn't remember Yosef, so you have to pause there for a second, and what's the first thing you have to ask is, why not? Now, again, let's be a little honest right here. We could have anticipated that based upon Yosef's economic laws, that there would have been backlash at some point against Yosef specifically or against the Jews generally. I mean, Yosef basically leveraged the whole country, you know, to the point that everybody lost their land and everybody was basically enslaved. So, right, but everybody was enslaved, so would that cause any kind of backlash? So I'm just, you know, raising that as a question. Or you want to say it a little differently, do Jews cause anti-Semitism? Right? So, by the way, probably the answer to that is no, because there are plenty of places with no Jews with plenty of anti-Semitism, so apparently we don't cause it. It's this otherworldly force that takes place. But was Yosef somehow responsible? So again, you read a verse that, you know, someone who doesn't remember Yosef, so now you have to ask a little further. And did the Jews remember Yosef? Which means, is Paro's bad memory, is that something independent, or is Paro's bad memory perhaps somehow connected to the Jews' bad memory? So that's, I'm just giving you an example of how I end Parsha Vayechi, I end Sefer Bereshit, I continue on to Shemot. It's not a new book that, you know, it's like, okay, I finished that book, now I'm reading a new book, and the new book has nothing to do with the old book, it has a lot of things with the old book. So that's one thing, to read it as a continuation, and I think that's very significant. Second point is to see Sefer Shemot as a comparison or contrast, and those are two very different words, as a comparison or as a contrast to Sefer Bereshit. Because when you do that, you're going to see all kinds of things you may just not have seen otherwise. So I'll give you. I'll start with a bad example. The reason why it's a bad example is that it's something which is more based on Chazal than it is based upon the text. So therefore, you'll be less convinced of this one, even though it's actually quite important. In the beginning of Sefer Bereshit, the Mishnah in Avot tells us that the world was created with 10 statements. The Eser Mamrot, God created the world. 10 statements. So then I look at Shemot, especially this week's Parsha, bit next week, we have 10 Makot. So is there any kind of relationship, correlation between the 10 statements which create the world and then the 10 Makot? Now, on a very superficial level, there really should be some kind of comparison taking place. And I'll tell you how superficial I'm willing to go. In the beginning, you have animals and you have fish and you have all kinds of things showing up. And over here, we have animals and we have fish and we have frogs and we have all kinds of things showing up. And you're going to now tell me, well, that's really superficial, right? Yes? You could say it. That's really superficial. Yes? Agreed. It's very superficial. But that doesn't mean that it's not true. Now, Bali Machshava will go one step further and say, and you can nuance it different ways, and it will take a lot of hard work to do this. I'm not going to do it for you. That you can choose to try to do it yourselves. But Baal HaMachshava, they're going to say that God created the world in 10 statements, and at a certain extent, the 10 Makot are a deconstruction of the world, or at least of a society, or at least of Egypt. So you have construction, then you have deconstruction. So when do you have reconstruction? Reconstruction is with Aseret HaDibrot, which means these three groups of 10 are far more significant theologically than perhaps you would have imagined. And yes, there are Baalei Machshava who work very hard to line them up directly and show you how they're related. That is not easy work, because that's not obvious in any way, shape, or form, to see how these 10 may be connected. I mean, an easy thing maybe to say, let there be light, and to say, oh, you have Makar Choshech. Okay, so you may find there's something, but I'll say it again. It's not the easiest thing to work them out, but that doesn't stop a lot of people from trying to work it out. Correct. I'm saying once you start thinking, you realize that this is not as bad as perhaps you thought it was when I started to say it, but it does take a great deal of work in order to make it really tight. And I said it's not so easy, but even though there may be difficulty in making it match, maybe that's the mistake. Maybe there's no reason to make it match. Maybe the fact that you have 10 and 10 and 10, that's really enough, even though the one that I said you're going to be most uncomfortable with is the 10 of creation, because it's not really, it doesn't say in the Torah itself, it's only, by the way, it's only a Mishnah in Avot that points it out. So that's why you're find it a little more difficult. So let's try all over again. A major theme in all of Sefer Bereishit, starting from the beginning, going all the way to the end, is the phenomenon of brothers not getting along. Starting with Cain and Hevel, going all the way through the end, although you can argue, if you really want to, that perhaps Ephraim and Menashe get along. There are certain midrashim which discuss it, although there's no evidence in the text which clearly supports it. What you have is a series of brothers not working out. Inevitably, you have the older brother being rejected, and inevitably, you have the younger brother being successful. As I said, that is a meta theme going all the way through the Bereishit, so much so that if you did something absurd, like your teacher would ask you, okay, write a book report, and you say, okay, I'm going to write it on Genesis. And my book report on Genesis is a book about brothers who don't get along. Yeah, there's some other details, other stories along the line, but that's really what the book is about. I think that's fine. I think it's absolutely true. That's really what the book is about. Now, how does Bereishit begin? And be very, very careful now in terms of the first brothers in Bereishit Perek Dalet. It's here someplace. I'm kidding, right? In Perek Dalet, we have two brothers who have no sense of brotherhood. Adam yadat chave ishto, and so on. And then you have the wonderful question, Vayomer Hashem El Kain. Well, that's not the way we want, a little bit after that. Vayomer Kain. Vayokum Kain El Hevel Achiv Vayargehu. You notice the Achiv jumping out of that pasuk? Didn't have to tell you Achiv. We all know it's Achiv. The fact they had the same mother and the same father was a giveaway on that. It could have just said that he, but you hear Achiv is being stressed in that pasuk. Vayomer Hashem El Kain, Ei Hevel Achicha. By the way, you notice what else could have worked without that word? Which word? Achicha. Ei Hevel. Where's Hevel? Vayomer, and he says, Lo Yadati, Hashomer Achi Anochi? Am I my brother's keeper, by the way? What's the answer to that question?
Yes.
Indeed. Yes. You are your brother's keeper. Which means even by asking that question, you realize there's something terribly wrong. So therefore, how does the first sibling relationship take place in Bereishit? It happens with two siblings who are at least one. We don't know about Hevel because we never hear him say anything. We have a relationship where one gets up, kills the other. By the way, I would visualize it even more than that, that he kills him. He has what? I don't know what the murder weapon is. What is it? Knife? Rock? Rock. You imagine rock, right? He's got a bloody rock in his hand, and he hides it behind him. And God says, where's Hevel, your brother? And he goes, am I my brother's keeper? Again, the blood dripping off. And so, I mean, it's a horrific, horrific scene. Compare that to the scene of Moshe going out in Perek Bet. Perek Bet Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayihi b'yamim ha'hem, vayigdal Moshe, vayetze el Echav. Now you notice how the word Echav jumps out there? What's interesting about the word Echav over here? What else is interesting? Why is it not necessary? So what's interesting is that it's not his brothers, in a literal sense. Which means, Cain kills Hevel, his literal brother. Why? Because he has no sense of brotherhood with the person who is his literal brother. What does it say by Moshe? Vayetze el Echav. Vayar b'sivotam. He sees their pain. Vayar ish mitzvi makeh etivri me Echav. Beating somebody from his brothers. So over here, it's the sense of brotherhood which is so significant. Because, again, just notice the difference between the books. In Bereishit, you have a murder taking place because of no sense of brotherhood. And over here, the beginning of Shemot, so now, be careful. Are you willing to call this a murder or not? Is this also a murder taking place? Yes, this is a murder. Moshe murders the Mitzri. Or Moshe kills the Mitzri.
Murder.
Say that again. Why is it murder? So what's the so basically we need a difference between a definition of murder versus killing. What's okay, but what's the definition of murder? What's the definition of killing? Yes. Actually, every word you use is semantics. Now, but in this particular sense, is the semantics... No. Slow down. In self-defense, do you murder or do you kill? I just used the word self-defense. Self-defense, do you murder or do you kill in self-defense?
You kill in self-defense.
Are you just giving in because it's going to keep bothering you? Yeah. No, what I would say is that murder is an unjustified taking of life and killing is justified. And in that part, I agree with you that we can all debate what's justified, what's not justified. That's certainly debatable. I mean, you've heard about a fellow named Gandhi. Was he a moral individual? So a lot of people in the world think he was very moral. When you have a chance, you can Google Gandhi and Holocaust and see what it says. He thought that the moral thing for Jews to do is to go to their deaths. And it was immoral to fight back against Nazis. By the way, I think that most people... Because it's immoral. It's based on a sentiment that probably he was against any violence, any act of violence, and he thought it was good for Jews to die. So, I'm just saying, it's the fact that he can say that it's immoral to fight against Nazis. See, the truth is I'm being a little unfair. Any time you have to bring Nazis into an argument, then it already shows that you're being desperate. So I'm obviously desperate in this because I'm bringing Nazis into the discussion. But the real reason I'm doing it is in order to get real simple clarity. So if a Nazi's trying to kill lots of Jews and you kill that Nazi, is that murder or is that considered to be some kind of self-defense or some kind of a justified taking of life? Again, and that's the whole issue. The politics, it's not semantics, it's politics. It's a big difference. The politics is when do you consider taking of a life justified, when do you not consider justified? So therefore, as you correctly pointed out, if I think that this person is evil and I kill him, then it's justified. If I think he's attacking me and I'm self-defense, it's justified. If I think I'm protecting my brother, then it's justified. So therefore, I'm going to come back again and say, when Cain kills Hevel, is that murder or is that killing? That's murder. Why? Because it's not justified. Unless you want to give a whole different argument and he didn't know the consequences of his actions. You want to say it was accidental. He didn't realize if he splits his head open with a rock that he may die. I'd rather not go there. What? As I said, if you want to go there, then you can. I'd rather not go there. I'd rather say there was an act of murder. But still, what I'm still trying to point out now is, do we all realize the beginning of Bereishit has one man killing another man because, or maybe we'll stay away from the killing versus murder. We'll try to keep that out of the sentence. One man taking the life of another man who happens to be his brother, because there's no sense of brotherhood, and therefore there's no value of that life. On the other hand, the beginning of Shemot has a story of one man taking the life of another man because he senses that other man is his brother and he thinks that he's vulnerable and he thinks that he's being hurt. So my point is, Bereishit begins with no sense of brotherhood, and therefore the word brother is used in that narrative very deliberately. Why? Because he really was his brother. Over here, when you read these words again, the beginning of Shemot, Vayihi, Vayimim, Ahim, Vayigdal, Moshe, Vayetzei, El Echav. He goes out to his brothers. One second. Do you realize how incredible that statement is, that he goes out to his brothers? Or all of you just want to take that for granted? How does Moshe know these are his brothers? Okay, and what does mother tell him? And how do you know that? Yeah.
Well, it was in the idea that he knew and he went out to his brothers. And he had some relation, he felt sympathy for them.
Okay, but you're working too hard. I'm willing to accept your point that Moshe is raised by his mother to know that these are his brothers. But I want to pause there a second. Do we all realize that that is something which is very interesting? What don't we know? We have no knowledge of any of the time frame in Moshe's life. Till the age of 80, we don't know anything. Actually, there's only two references we have. He's 3 months old when they can't hide him anymore. And if according to tradition he really was born in Zayin Adar, that means that Moshe is hidden until Chag HaShavuot, and then Moshe gets revealed in Chag HaShavuot, and at that point he gets thrown into the water, and presumably on the same day he gets taken out of the water. All of that would be early historical events that took place on the holiday of Shavuot, more or less. We don't know how long he's nursed by his mother, but we can now guess that his mother has taught him. And let's start with a minimum of one thing. What has she taught him? She's taught him that he is a, for lack of a better word, you want to say Jew, you want to say Hebrew, that he is one of these, and that Moshe can grow up and walk out of the palace and look at the situation. I'm not only talking about the fact that he gets involved. The fact that he gets involved is a separate point. There's a primary point. The primary point is his vantage point. When he walks out of the palace, what does he see? What does he seek? And the words say it very clearly. He goes out to his brothers. That seems to say, I think, pretty clearly that he knows they're his brothers. Vayar b'sivlotam. He sees their suffering. Vayar ish mitzri makei ish ivri me echav. He sees his brother being beaten. Vayifen ko b'chol vayar ki ein ish. Vayachet mitzri vayitmeneu b'chol. So this whole sequence or story is framed with Moshe's sense of brotherhood, while the whole story of Cain and Hevel is framed with a sense of brotherhood. But again, just one question. What's the difference between those stories? One is somebody taking a life because he doesn't sense the brotherhood, which is there, and the other somebody taking a life because he senses the brotherhood, which is there. So that's what I'm saying, is that when you compare this early part of these two parshiot, or these two books even, you say, hold it, there is a little bit more there than you would have noticed. I want to flip it around and go the other way. I think, and here, this is going to be much harder to prove, I think that Moshe's mother actually gave him one more message, at least. I mean, I think it's if you want to torture yourself, this is really, that's what this is. You want to torture yourself, you can ask yourself the following question. If you're going to have 1 or 2 or maybe 3 years with your kid, 4 years, I don't know how long she can hold on to him, and you can only teach him a limited amount, what do you teach him? Do you start with Gemara? I don't know. What is it that you're going to teach him? Because this is the message he's going to have to walk away with. So okay, perhaps Shema Yisrael. So you teach him monotheism. You teach him one God. Good. What else perhaps do you teach him with?
God's
age. So I'm willing to bet that that there's two parts at least, and then you can add as much as you want in your own fantasies. One is she teaches him that he is a Jew. The evidence for that, I said, is right here, black and white. I think that, I mean, you could argue, but you can argue anything. But I think it's pretty clear. The second thing, which I think is much more difficult to argue with, I think she teaches him that he's not the first person to ever be in this situation. I think she goes into, and you could say, where am I getting this from? Are you making this all up? I think she goes in and she tells him a little bit of the Yosef story. And that's why I want to say again that this book is a continuation of the book of Bereshit. Why would the Yosef story be important? Because Yosef is a role model. You're not the first Jew who's being raised in the palace. You're not the first Jew who's living in the palace. You're not the first Jew who's ever had an opportunity because he's in a palace. And I want to make an observation on this. One of the things that we don't notice, that hopefully you will notice, only a Bal Kori can get this, what I'm going to say now, unless you're really sensitive, and that is that, any Bal Koris here? Is that there is a interesting connection between the last part of Bereshit, meaning from the beginning of the Yosef stories till the end, especially Miketz, there is a connection between those parshiot, or those sections, and Megillat Esther. Thematically and linguistically. It's the story of a beautiful Jew who's in the palace, in a position, and the way it gets articulated in Megillat Esther, well, maybe for this reason you were put here. Yosef has that sense from the very beginning. For this reason he's put there. Which means a beautiful Jew in the palace is the connection between the Yosef and the Esther stories. And I'm saying if you start looking, you'll find all kind of connections. After thinking of this a while, actually in a bookstore was wandering and I found a book, somebody wrote a whole book on this, trying to point out the connections. There are many, many connections between the two. Moshe would be a continuation of the same idea, where some of the ideas that get articulated by Esther, again, perhaps for this exact reason you're in the palace, that has to be what Moshe's mother is thinking, by saying that you're being put there, but there must be a divine plan, there must be part of this divine plan, which is why you're there in the first place. So what I'm therefore claiming is that Moshe would see his great-great-uncle Yosef as the role model and part of the message that she imparts with him. Can anybody prove this? Or bring some kind of evidence? Should I interpret your silence as you want me to continue? Moshe obviously tries to do something. What's the great irony? It doesn't work. And he ends up losing his job and ends up wandering away. By the way, when he wanders away, he marries the daughter of a Kohen, just like Yosef did, has 2 kids, just like Yosef did. I'm saying the parallels there, which don't impress you at all, are right there as you continue. It's only later on, after he gives up, that God says, okay, now turn around and go back. I mean, Moshe tries. He really does try. It just doesn't work out. Yeah.
Yosef takes them into Galus, Moshe takes them out of Galus.
Good. So on the one hand, I can say Yosef, because of Yosef they go in, because Moshe they go out. But there's also something very interesting. When it comes time to leave, it says that all the Jews go running around and looking for the gold and the silver and the clothes and all the things with their neighbors, right? They all take advantage, take everything. Moshe alone does something else. What does Moshe do? Moshe goes looking for Yosef. And again, I want you to think about this for a second. And this is expanded a bit in the Midrash. But again, think about this comparison. I would venture to say that the Jews during their years of servitude most likely were inspired or even motivated by the thought, God promised that we're going to be slaves in a land which isn't ours, and the day is going to come, and we're going to leave with great wealth. So, you know, it's one thing to be a slave, it's another thing to really have faith, and to say, okay, that day is going to come. Our day is going to come. and you've been looking into the window of your Egyptian neighbor saying, okay, the day's going to come, I'm taking that, this is mine, right? And I'm going to get paid. Every time you work, every time you put in overtime, every brick that you make, right? You're saying, I'm going to get paid for this. So that itself could keep you going during all the tough times. So isn't it interesting then that all the Jews go look for the money when it's time to leave, but Moshe goes looking for Yosef? Because I think that's the exact parallel. Who was it or what was it that kept Moshe going during all the tough times? I think that was Yosef. And it's that image of Yosef. So therefore, what we have over here is, okay, just to try this one more time. We have at the same time, give me one second, we have at the same time the parallels taking place, beginning of Bereshit, beginning of Shemot, and on the other hand we have the continuation of the story, going from the Yosef story, blending into the Moshe story. Of course, the intriguing part is a new Paro who doesn't remember Yosef, and maybe an entire Jewish people who no longer remember Yosef. And that's a scary thought, because what exactly does that mean? And again, I want to go one step further with this, and then we'll take some thoughts and pause a little bit. I don't know, but let's just go a little further, and let me suggest something. You've been told that the Jews sunk to the 49th level of Tum'ah. Yes? And where does it say that? It does say that in the Zohar. Actually, the Zohar Chadash, it says it. But okay. I won't argue with you on that. So, the Jews sunk to the 49th level of Tum'ah. So what does it mean they were guilty of? Meaning, what were their sins? I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you have a point system. This sin gets one level of Tum'ah. You could just fail another whole 8 levels of Tum'ah. There are certain sins you can do. If you're from California, you can go another, bunch of levels of Tum'ah. So, California. So how do you get to the 49th level of Tum'ah? I mean, that's not an easy thing. So what exactly did they do? So in order to ask what they did, I think you have to flip it around a little bit and say, okay, but what exactly was expected of them? Meaning, what are our expectations of the Jews? So if you're particularly frum, so then you say that they were supposed to be keeping Taryag Mitzvot, Avram kept Pesach and Simchas Torah, lit Chanukah candles, unless it was a Shas Sakana, and then he maybe lit them inside. So, that is very funny. But still, I mean, what exactly, and I'm saying in a real sense, what exactly was really their Judaism at that point? And now I want to pause. Before I continue with this thought, I want to pause. I do want to start this week's parasha, but maybe I'll tell you one secret first. The Midrash says, and it should be very, very obvious, the Midrash says that the thing that they stopped keeping was Brit Milah. Okay, Brit Milah is a little awkward. Brit Milah is not the easiest mitzvah, Brit Milah. But you realize, of course, when the Midrash points at that one specifically, that's the thing they stopped doing, you realize why that's interesting. Why? Why is that interesting? Well, that will definitely make that whole story that much more interesting. Why is it interesting that it says you're working? That's much too hard. Much more obvious. Why would that be an interesting mitzvah of all mitzvah? Why would that be an interesting? It's the only one they're commanded. Stop. It's the only one they're really commanded. So, oh no, it just happens to be they didn't do this one. They weren't commanded all the other ones yet. I mean, that's exactly the point. To say, oh, they didn't keep Rit Milah. So what does that mean they didn't keep Rit Milah? So what did they keep? Second day Yontif? Again. Think about it a second. They kept Peru of Rome? Okay. Baruch Hashem. No, I'll tell you what they did. They didn't learn on Nitelnacht. Okay? And they were machmir according to the Greek Orthodox Church as well. Okay? What? They went over your head. I was worried about saying that. I don't know if anybody would understand that. But that was also, by the way, that was very funny. You should ask somebody. Anyway. So I'm saying, what exactly is the nature of their Judaism to say they did or they didn't do a particular thing? So Brit Milah, to say, oh, they just didn't have to keep Brit Milah. Whoa. That's significant. How does this parsha begin? Just So you, by the time I finish today, no one's going to say, yeah, that was okay, but I don't think you knew which parsha you were learning this week. So how does this week's parsha begin? Excuse me? Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe vayomer elov ani Hashem. By the way, that should be confusing. Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe vayomer elov ani Hashem. Like, but also make up your mind. Like, which one? Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe vayomer elov ani Hashem. Ve'ira el Avram v'Yitzchak v'Yaakov b'kel Shakai u'shmi Hashem lo nadati lahem. Okay, who am I? So it's Elokim saying I'm Hashem, but I've passed off checks as Kel Shakai. Right? That's... No? How would you say it?
Was it Elokim vis-a-vis the Egyptians? He was going to exact judgment on them. But towards Moshe, he was now...
Vayidaber Elokim el Moshe. Why not Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe? Excellent. Rashi lives. Okay, good. No, good. That's right, more or less, that was...
Yeah.
I recognize it. Look, he said, that sounds familiar. Okay, excellent, yes. You're also going to tell me Rashi. Okay. But even with Rashi, it's still very interesting. He spoke to the Avot as Kel Shakai. Okay, how many times? Once? Okay. How many times is Kel Shakai? Because also Rashi gives you some. This is going to be all of them. How many times is Shakai mentioned in the Chumash? How many times is it mentioned Sefer VaYikra? How many times is Sefer Bamidbar? Okay. How many times is Sefer Devarim? How many times is Sefer Shemot? How many times is Sefer Bereishit? You're guessing. Anyway. No. Okay. And more importantly, what does the name Shakai mean? What does the name actually mean when God says, okay, this is how I used to go, but this is, okay. The first time it's used is in Bereshit Yud Zayin. I'll start giving you some hints now. Avram is 99 years old. So now you know he doesn't use it for the first 98 years of Avram's life. It's actually never used before. First time it's there in Avram's 99. What's going to happen now when he's 99? Good. One part is the name change. What else is there?
Bris.
Okay. And he's also the land of Israel, thrown into it for good measure. So let's actually read what it says, because all of that you should have thought through. Now let's read. Vayihi, this is Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Aleph. Vayihi Avraham ben Tishim Shana v'Teisha Shanim. Vayera Hashem al Avraham, which is interesting. Vayera, here we have a Vayera Hashem al Avraham. Vayoma Elav Ani Kel Shakai. Hitalech Lefanai v'yet tamim. So tmimut is also very interesting in this context. Ve'nebriti b'ni uveinecha v'arbe otcha b'ma'od ma'od. So, covenant and arbe. What does arbe mean? Multiply, or we'll use a different word perhaps, fertility. Your name will no longer be Avram, will be Avraham. Next. Vakimoti briti beni uveinecha, uvein zaracha acharech ledoratem, brit olam liotacha lelohim lezarecha acharecha, v'natati lecha ulezaracha acharecha et eretz mugurecha, et kol eretz kanan lechuzat olam v'yita lehem lelohim. V'yom elkim el avram, v'ata et briti tishmor atov zarecha acharech ledoratem, zo briti asher tishmu beni uveinechem, and it goes on to say, himol lachem kol zachor. So we have Brit Milah, land of Israel, fertility, are the elements which are mentioned in this section. So we don't make any mistakes. The next time is in Perek Kav Chet. Vayikra Yitzchak el Yaakov, Yivarech Oto, Yitzaveo, Vayomer Lo, Lo Tikach Isha Mibnot Knan. Don't marry a local girl. Kum Lech Padena Aram, Beita b'tuel avi imecha v'kach chamisham isham ibnot lavan achi imecha v'kel shakai yivarechotcha v'yafricha v'yirbecha v'yitilakal amim. What do we have in common over here? Shakai and fertility. Next one, v'yomer lo elokim perek lamed hey pasuk yud. V'yomer lo elokim shemcha Yaakov lo yikare shemcha od Yaakov ki im Yisrael yesh shemecha v'yikor shmo Yisrael. V'yomer lo elokim ani kel shakai perei urevei goy kahal goyim yem imecha u'malachim michalatzecha yetzeu. What is the, are you willing to now stage guess what the name Shakai is related to? We have three times in a row, and three times in a row, what is the common denominator? Fertility. So I'm just saying that really should be black and white. What else do you know about the name Shakai? It's on a mezuzah. Okay, that else you know. It sticks on the outside of a mezuzah. That's the other thing that you know about it. Okay. It's used again in Perek Mem Gimel. This is the only one you can give me a hard time about, but if you really think about it, you'll realize it fits in as well. It's when Yaakov is very nervous. He's about to send Binyamin to meet this unknown man, and he says, "V'kel shakai yitain lachem rachamim lefnei ha'ish v'shilach lachem et achichem acher v'et Binyamin v'ani kasher shakalti shakalti." Which, by the way, is just like by Megillat Esther, "Kasher avadati avadati kasher shakalti shakalti." This is one of the many examples which would be a comparison. Over here, he's worried about losing his child and losing fertility, losing Binyamin. But by the way, unbeknownst to Yaakov, the person who he's directing this to is actually to Yosef, which is important because the rest of the times the name Shakai is used, all of it's going to be end up directing to Yosef, eventually till Yaakov gives him this bracha. This is the bracha that he's going to give him, but just quickly... Memchet v'yomer Yaakov v'Yosef kel shakai nireh lai v'luz beretz Kanaan v'yivarech oti v'yomer elai hineni me'afrecho v'bitecha, and so on. Again, the bracha of fertility, which is really a restatement of a previous one. And finally, Perek Mem Tet. This is the bracha that Yaakov gives to Yosef. Ben parat Yosef, so on. Mekel avicha v'yazrecha v'et shaddai v'yivarechacha brichot shamayim me'al brichot tahom rovetz etachat brichot shaddayim v'racham Brichot avicha gavrua brichot harai ad tavat kavot olam tiyena l'rosh Yosef ulakot kod nizir achav. That all of this is going to Yosef. But by the way, did you notice the content of the bracha here as well? It wasn't just peruvu, it was more than that. It actually said very clearly, it said brichot shadayim v'racham, blessings of the breasts and of the womb, which is absolutely blessings of fertility, in the most obvious, clear way that one can possibly articulate it. That's really what this bracha is. Now, the Gemara says, and I heard you say the Gemara a moment ago, the Gemara explains the name Shaddai means what? Again? Correct. So read the Gemara. This is Gemara in Chagiga on Daf Yud Bet. V'amor v'yehuda marav, b'sho shabarach kodesh baruch hu et ha'olam haya marchiv v'holech b'shtei p'kiyot al shoshati. When God created the world, it expanded, expanded, and expanded. Now, I want to stop for a second, because we need to understand this. When you read the Rashi's, it's okay? When you read the Rashi's, and Rashi dealt with Yud Kei Vav Kei and Elokim, which was the real name of God, and which one does he just use? What's God's real name? Is it Elohim? Is it Yudke Vavke? Or is it Shakai? Rashi actually said it there.
Shmi Hashem.
Shmi Hashem. Shmi Hashem. My real name is Yudke Vavke. It says it right there. My real name is Yudke Vavke. Good. So where's Elohim come from? Bereshit Bar Elohim. What's Elohim? The Zohar. There's Tikkuni Zohar now. Not Zohar Chadash. Right? Just in case you can get there yet. The Tikkuni Zohar says, it's another book. The Tikkuni Zohar says that Bereshit Bara Elokim, actually Tikkuni Zohar has 70 different interpretations of the first pasuk of the Torah. That Bereshit Bara Elokim means Bereshit, the first thing that God created was Elokim. That the real essence of God is Yud Kei Vav Kei. What does Yud Kei Vav Kei mean? Ho Yehovah V'yiyah. Completely transcendental. What does Elohim create? What does Yud Kei Vav Kei create? It creates Elohim. What's Elohim? So many Balei Machshava say Elohim, but Gematria is Hateva. By the way, it doesn't work if you do it with a Kuf. You have to use the hay. Okay? So I can just see somebody say, no, it doesn't work. No. It's Elohim with a hay. So Elohim with a hay is ha-teva. So God, it's this concept of teva. Concept of teva, by the way, is related to midat hadin. God transcends nature, transcends everything, transcends time, space, and matter. That is complete rachamim. God had to create. When God creates another, he needed to create justice as well. Elohim, teva. Now, get back to this Gemara that just now told us that God created the world, and the world started spreading and spreading and spreading out. That's nature. Which means the real reality is no time, no space, no matter. God creates, and it spreads out. So, I'm going to tell you what I think it means. You can argue, but this is what I think it means. God creates us as human beings, and we are all subject to nature. What's the problem with nature? Is the problem with nature is we're beings of nature, is that therefore we are subject to instinct. And that's the problem of it spreading and spreading and spreading out, is that we just act by instinct. What does, continue the Gemara then, it says, I'm skipping a little bit, V'hainu d'omare shlokish, my dichtiv, ani kel shakai, ani hu shamarti la'olam dai. I'm the one who says to the world, to this created world, die, stop, limitations. So now, how in the world are limitations somehow connected to this name Shakai or the context that it was introduced in? So it's the opposite of? Well, one second, fertility is extended. But how is it connected to the context? Say that again.
God is saying, this is, I can say enough is enough for something. I can stop saying that. I can stop one from giving birth. So too, I'm going to say that she can give birth as well.
So you gave a good explanation, but you didn't do what I asked you to do. I asked you to find to go back to context. You looked at the general way that it's used. Context. Context. Where's the first time that it's used? What's the context? Yes, thank you. We ended up understanding that it means fertility because looking at all the times that it's used. What was the context the first time it was introduced? It's Bris Milah. Is Bris Milah at all related to this idea of fighting against instinct, creating limitations? So that means that's exactly what it is. I mean, you read this Gemara and you say, no, God creates the world and Avram's orientation is one of nature. So Avram looks at nature, realizes it's a god. But the problem is, you cannot have a religion unless you believe that man has a capability of practicing self-control. God starts the religion by giving Avraham this mitzvah of Brit Milah, changes his name. Why does he change his name? Because he just had a bris. You give somebody a name at a bris. They probably served bagels also then, right? You think I'm kidding, right? And lox. He became Jewish at that particular point. Now we can have fertility of the Jewish variety. Now the Jewish people can come in, which means, yes, the name is used with fertility subsequently, but it's used for fertility subsequently because Brit Milah is introduced, right? So now, as I said, when you follow all the usages of this, it keeps going back to fertility, and it keeps on focusing on Yosef. At the end of the day, this all comes Yosef. Now, what in the world does Yosef have to do with Brit Milah? Because Yosef is the one who shows that he's able to practice self-control, which is, that exactly is Yosef HaTzadik, Tzadik Yisod Olam. Yosef is the person who's Shomer HaBrit. Yosef is the one who's now completely connected to this name, Shakai. By the way, even though Yosef in his speech, when he talks, he always talks about Elohim. This would be a sin against God. He talks about judgment. He calls, there would be sin against my master, sin against God, right? Et Elohim Ani Yarei, Elohim Omer LaParo, right? It's always Elohim. Yosef is always there with this idea. But nonetheless, in his behavior, Yosef keeps controlling himself, right? Limiting himself, holding back. We constantly see that with Yosef. So Yosef is the one who inherits all of this. But as I said, the language over here is so blatant, right? You see what I'm saying? The language here is so blatant when it comes to the connection between Shakai and fertility. I actually have to make another suggestion. That, right, we saw blessings of Shaddayim Viracham, of the breast and the womb, that maybe even the name Shaddai is connected to the word, not just no, it's connected to the word to the breast as well. And that's, which is almost then to say that maybe the name over here is connected to God in a sense as a protective mother. Which, by the way, now think about that in terms of the name on the mezuzah, on the house, this protection. And think now about Moshe refusing to be nursed by the Egyptian woman and only will go back to his own mother to be nursed, just in terms of this whole concept of Shaddai over here, which is going, again, flows to Yosef. Yosef now is going to become the role model of Moshe. But by the way, all that's not enough. Because God is saying, you know, that's how it was, and now we're going forward. Which means that's enough to create the Jewish people. The name Shaddai creates the Jewish people. Without it, we can't have a Jewish people. Without the ability of man's belief that we can control instinct, religion is an absurdity, right? I'm saying the most obvious thing in the world. This doesn't, you know, take much. I'll say it again, because it's so obvious. Without the belief that man has the ability of practicing self-control, religion is an absurdity. Because I can just say, no, I'm a biological being, and I'm just based upon nature, and whatever I feel like doing, that's what I have to do. I have compulsion, and I just can't control myself. That's what I am. And what does religion say? No, you have the ability of control. This really becomes connected to this idea of Shaddai, and therefore, when we need this, it goes in a circle almost. When we need this protection, that's this concept of Shaddai, which is upon the Jewish people, that creates the Jewish people, that's the idea of the Brit Milah, and as I said, the person who ends up manifesting this is Yosef, and Yosef now is all set to be the role model of Moshe, but it's only till one particular point. And the point that it stops really is when we get to the burning bush. Yeah, go ahead.
If Yosef is so awesome, and we have this, you know, everybody, the younger brother winning and stuff, why, at the end of the day, Yosef doesn't win?
There's a negativity to Yosef. Did I talk about this? I didn't talk about this? A little bit. There's a negativity to Yosef that every now and then can emerge as well. All of this is there until the burning bush. By the burning bush, we have a whole new presentation. Look at Perek Gimel, which is actually fascinating, the first pasuk. Moshe haya ro'eh etzon. Before I'm stopping halfway in the sentence. Why is that significant? Because he's acting like a Hebrew by being a shepherd and not like an Egyptian. The Egyptians detest this. That's what meaning Moshe's looking back for his... In a certain sense, I mean, this is going to be totally unfair, but in a certain sense, Moshe's about tshuva. So Moshe knows this is what his ancestors does. So Moshe's about tshuva, is going back to connect to his ancestors. That's what Moshe's doing. U'Moshe yaroa etzon yitro chotno kohen midyan. And again, I pointed out that Yosef marries the daughter of Potipharah Kohen, right? Over here, he marries the daughter of a Kohen. As I said, you can do with this as you like. He's searching out Har Elokim, Chorev. Vayera, again, Vayera. Here we have this, we had the Vayera right where we started, Vayera back by Avram, and now we have Vayera. What does he see? Malach Hashem. What does Hashem mean? What does the name Hashem mean? Ho Yehovah V'yia. How do you have a Malach Hashem? Malach Elokim, I understand. Malach Elokim can stand there with a sword and smack you upside the head. What's a Malach Hashem? I know you didn't stop right away and say, wow, that's Malach Hashem. That's so unusual. What's a Malach Hashem doing over here? Malach Hashem is a very strange term. What is the Malach? What is the Malach Hashem? What's Hashem? Again, it is transcendental. What does he see? V'yera Malach Hashem elav b'lav as'esh mitoch hasneh. V'yar v'yne hasneh bo'er v'esh v'asneh einu ukal. He sees a bush which is burning but not being consumed. What is that a representation of? of something transcendental. Normally, something burning gets consumed. He sees something burning, not being consumed, which means, where's the Malach Hashem? Oh, it's that little guy with the white, you know, dressed in white with the wings. No. The Malach Hashem is the Sneh, which means already at this point, Moshe is being introduced to something transcendental. There's only one problem, by the way. And what's the problem? He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand what he's saying. It says, Vayom Moshe Asur Navera Tamara Agadol Azem, Adu Alo Yivar HaSneh. Which is, he doesn't say, wow, I see an angel over here, a representation of something which is transcendental. What does he say instead? This is impossible. Vayar Hashem, Yudke Vavke, Kisar Lerot, Vayikra Elov Elokim, Mitoch HaSneh Vayom Moshe Moshe Vayom Hineni. God knows that Moshe is not getting it, so he speaks to him as Elokim. He introduces himself, Kel, Elokei, Elokei, Elokei. But Yistar Moshe at Panav Kira Me'abit Elokim. He's afraid. He has no idea. He just now saw some kind of Malach Hashem, and he's afraid of looking at Elokim. But Yomar Hashem, Ra'o Ra'iti et Onim Ami, Asher B'Mitzrayim, Ve'etzakatam Shemati, and so on. He gives the whole speech, how I've seen the suffering, and so on. Finally, Vayomer Moshe Elokim, right? He goes again. He keeps talking to Elokim. Mi Anochi Galecha Paro V'Chutziat Bnei Yisrael Mitzrayim. Vayomer Ki Ehiye Imach V'Zelocha Haot. I'm going to be with you. Ki Anochi Shlachticha Botziacha Ta'ami Mitzrayim Tavdunet Elokim Al Har Hazeh. Vayomer Moshe Elokim Mi Anochi Bal Bnei Yisrael V'Amarti Lahem Elokei Avotechem Shalachani Aleichem Vayomer. Li mashmo ma'amar lechem. Who should I say is calling? Vayomer Elokim el Moshe ehiye asher ehiye. Vayomer kol tamar v'nei Yisrael ehiye shalachani aleichem. We're running out of time, and you have to eat. So I'm going to, cut all of this short. Rashi over here says the most frightening thing. I want to go back to the Rashi in the beginning of the parasha that you cited. Rashi there says, "What's yudke vavke? I keep the promises. Like all the promises are going to come true." So the avot, I made promises, I didn't keep them. I said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, but I didn't keep them, now I'm going to keep them. But over here, he says something else. He says, Ayesher, I'll be with you in this problem, and I'll be with you in the next galut. And Moshe, what? Like, the next, you know what, don't even tell him. Just say that I'll be with you, I'm with you. See, the problem over here, what I've been playing with, this whole idea of the different names, they're very, very significant. In fact, you can't understand what's going on. This connection with Bereshit is very important. The continuation of the story going from Yosef to Moshe is very important. The idea that we're standing on holy ground, the last time there was holy ground was the Garden of Eden. Over there by the Garden of Eden, there was a snake. The snake represented sin. What's going to happen over here? Moshe's going to be told, I'll take your stick, put it down, it turns into a snake. You can now pick it up because you can control it. You can control the snake. You can turn the snake back into a stick. You have the ability of controlling things. In the very beginning of Bereshit, God is hanging out with them. The book is not going to end until the Shekhinah is going to come down and fill up the Mishkan, just like it was in the Garden of Eden. In the Garden of Eden, after the whole thing, man is expelled, what's going to happen afterwards? You're going to have two Kruvim guarding the path to Derech Eitz Chaim. What's going to happen when you have the Mishkan built? You're going to have the two Kruvim standing on top of the Aron, where the glory of God is there. Eitz Chaim, what's Eitz Chaim? Eitz Chaim is the Torah. Torah Eitz Chaim, the Machzikim Bo, which means the beginning of Bereshit is going to flow through this entire book of Shemot. These are not separate stories. This is a continuation of the same story. But the problem is we generally don't see it because we get so micro-focused on the little details along the way. A key way of unraveling some of the information over here is paying attention to the names of God which are being used over here. The most important one I'm not going to do right now, B'li Neder, in terms of what it really means by Yudke Vavke over here, B'li Neder, I'll still come back to it, but the place that it gets solved is not here. The place it gets solved is by Mechemet Amalek, where God swears in terms of a case ka, where his name is not complete and his throne is not complete, where as much as God says, I'm going to keep all the promises, yeah, he's going to keep all the promises, but in the right time. And the right time is not necessarily here yet. Yeah.
Is there just any significance whenever God uses
Kel? Yes. Yes, there's significance to every one of those things. And just in case you're interested, Bible criticism when it deals with names. It creates whole theologies of these names, or actually theologies in the worst form, theories about the names, ignoring theology. And that's exactly the issue here. The names are really quite significant. What we did see today was a little bit about what this name Shakai or Shaddai means, but I'm pointing out that's really important to understand the connection between Yosef and between Moshe, and there is a direct connection between the two of them, so much so that Moshe, I believe his mother told him about Yosef, but at some point Moshe is going to go beyond Yosef. Moshe is going to go and connect to this Yudkei Vavkei, and Moshe is going to see things being completed that Yosef never saw. And Moshe is, and Yosef is the one who's going to lead them out. Again, leading somebody into slavery is not the same thing as taking them out of slavery, but understanding how he acknowledged the names is the first key to be able to unravel all of this. Stay there. We will continue.
Why does Chris Mueller represent limitation? Because you're cutting something off.
Why does Chris Mueller represent what?
Limitation, because you're cutting something off.
Yeah. Thank you.